Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I am Lauren Tenney, and this is the Talk with Tenney show. I want to thank you for listening and introduce you to the subject tonight, which is peer certification and Medicaid. That is not the only subject. If you have something you'd like to talk about, feel free to call in. Area code 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. And if you are not calling in because of long distance issues and you live in the United States in the lower 48, you can call toll free 855-346-3351. 855-346-3351. And so I bring this issue of peer certification and Medicaid up, making peer services Medicaid billable. I bring this up not because I want to, but I think that we have to talk about this. New York, I'm from New York, where the process of peer specialists becoming Medicaid billable is just underway. And so while it was always something that we fought against and that we didn't think was something that would be good for the idea of mutual assistance, which is one of the things that is usually carried out through a quote-unquote peer support relationship, I'm really frightened by some of the things that I hear are happening under the terms of what is peer support when it becomes Medicaid billable, and how the naturalness of it is really taken away. And so I've been looking at some different materials that have been generated over the years concerning what is a peer support. And the International Association of Peer Supporters webpage has a wealth of information about what this is. And I think that it's important in my reading of what it is that they are saying is peer support. And I'm just going to read from the site for a second. The definition of peer supporter: the term peer supporter is an umbrella for many different peer support titles and roles, such as peer advocate, peer counselor, peer coach, peer mentor, peer educator, peer support group leader, peer wellness coach, recovery support specialist, and many more. The International Association of Peer Supporters say that the, or peer specialist, of peer supporters, it says, in general, a peer supporter is an individual who has made a personal commitment to his or her own recovery, has maintained that recovery over a period of time, has taken a special training to work with others, and is willing to share what he or she has learned about recovery in an inspirational way. In many states, the website goes on to say, there is an official certification process, training, and test to become a qualified, quote, peer specialist. Not all states certify peer support providers, but most organizations require peer support providers who are employed need to complete training that is specific to the expected responsibilities of the job or volunteer work. Often a peer supporter has extra incentive to stay well because he or she is a role model for others. And so I really wish, if you have something to say about this, that you call in or leave me here talking to myself in public. Area code 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. I understand that this is a very hot issue, and that many people who work, I guess I should say this just right out front, many people who work in these roles of peer specialists or peer supporters are some of my dearest and closest friends. And so I understand why people have pride in the work that they do, and why and how they do it. And I think that I just need to make that clear to people that this is, but that the foundational principles of what mutual assistance was originally about and mutual support was about was not about a paid relationship between two people. And so while the International Association of Peer Supporters, you know, says that those who provide authentic peer support believe in recovery and work to promote the values that recovery is a choice, recovery is unique to the individual, recovery is a journey, not a destination, and self-directed recovery is possible for everyone with or without professional help, including the help of peer specialists or peer providers. You know, that when you start to get into the role of where people are working in peer roles in places that are involved in carrying out the activities of coerced, court-ordered, or uninformed psychiatric involvement of somebody, then the idea that choice is really limited significantly, and issues of informed consent come up as a struggle. If you'd like to call in, the number is area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. And that toll-free line is 855-346-3351. So when we look at what the guidelines are that are put out, there's a document, the definition of peer support, let me just back up here a second, you can find on the International Association of Peer Supporters webpage, which is I-N as in Nancy, A-O-P as in Peter, S.org/definition-peer-specialist/. Or if you go under the home page, it's the very first tab under the home page of definition of peer supporter. And I think that it's important for people to know that over the last couple of decades, what's happened is that each go-around in trying to maintain the importance of having independent external advocacy and supports that are not termed inside of psychiatric anything, it keeps getting withered away each time. And so the people who are involved widely, who are coming in right now, for example, and all they're given information about is these tests that they're taking that has maybe a general broad brushstroke of some of the history of our movement, but not necessarily any real detailed explanation as to what the values of the movement are or why it is that they're there, because we have to keep on changing the words that we use in order to continue getting the funding for this. And the idea of, from a state that doesn't yet have Medicaid billable peer specialists working, but knowing how many people are working in the system with the idea that they will get good, that this idea that what is just said, quote from the INAOPS website, often a peer supporter has extra incentive to stay well because he or she is a role model for others. And in the movement I grew up in, literally coming in from the youth movement to the mental patients liberation movement, there was an absolute demand that we were not seen as role models, and that we were people who were doing independent external advocacy, and that this idea of what is stay well is really concerning to me, because stay well implies or suggests that there is some universal definition of what quote-unquote well is. And so one of the things that I've always had an issue with the wellness model is that wellness is just another medicalized term as opposed to illness, generally. I understand many people say it much more holistically than that, but still, when you look at the antonym for well, it's ill. And so it's still within a perhaps more holistic model, but a holistic model all the same. And I think part of what the liberation movement was talking about, and my understanding of it, was that this was about our rights being infringed and this fraud of psychiatry being perpetrated against people with great abuse, sometimes to the extent of torture, and which is, you know, in 2008 and 2013, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Convention Against Torture has said that several of psychiatry's routine practices do constitute torture or ill treatment. And in 2008, it was that it may constitute torture or ill treatment, and this includes electroshock, forced drugging, restraint, seclusion, electric shocks, skin shocks, like they use at JRC. So the idea that there's something voluntary going on here for many people, and what wellness is, remains to be a problem for me. And so I've been looking around, and I found this article I found this article and then I lost this article. There it is. Okay, sorry. You can find this article on the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services website, www.cms.gov/MMRR/downloads, or you could just Google the impact of Medicaid peer support utilization on cost. And so this is an article that came out in Medicare and Medicaid Research Review, 2014, Volume 4, Number 1. And it says that it's a publication of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Office of Information Products and Data Analysis. And it was written by Glenn Landers and Mei Zhu, Georgia State University, Georgia Health Policy Center. And in this article, it says, the background, I'm just going to read from it. It says, peer support programs have proliferated over the past decade, building on recovery-oriented programming. Yet relationships between peer support services and the cost to public programs have not been well described in literature. The purpose of this study is to fill the gaps in the literature related to peer support programs and costs, lack of comparison groups, small sample sizes, and the availability of research examining utilization of Medicaid mental health services. And so their method was to go back in time and then make comparisons among three different models and groups and compare people. And I'm not exactly sure, like, whether or not this is legitimate, like, this makes sense to the values of what the movement are. But so, you know, understanding that there may be some serious critical methodological issues that exist in this work, and I'm not saying one way or the other whether there are or not, I just don't know. But when you look down to see what their results are, they write, peer support was associated with 5,991 higher total Medicaid cost. So $5,991 higher total Medicaid cost, which they say peer support was also associated with higher crisis stabilization cost and lower psychiatric cost. And so while there's less money being spent on institutions, which is good because it means people aren't being institutionalized as much, that there is now the cost is being shifted over to crisis stabilization costs, which would be, you know, if they were doing like real genuine peer-run respites and that was what they were billing it as, that would be one thing, but I don't know what exactly it is they're doing. Now, here's where I really get concerned. It says, but the relationships were not statistically significant between the higher crisis stabilization cost and the lower psychiatric hospitalization cost. But where it really gets very, very concerning to me is that it said peer support was associated with $2,100 higher prescription drug cost and $5,116 higher professional service cost and $1,225 lower facility cost. So again, people are not, there was a lower cost in institutionalization for the facility, it seems, based on this Medicaid, Medicare publication, but the costs for psychiatric drugs, psychiatric workers were higher. And part of that is, I think, what some of us keep on expressing concern about this, you know, peer specialist certification, is that you have people who have no idea about this movement. Maybe once they're involved, they'll find out something through somebody. But in their early stages of going through training and going through testing, they know little about the actual liberation movement that some people say was largely bought out by the federal government in the mid-'80s. And they just don't know. So that they're going by the idea that if they stay in services, they'll be well. And part of what the job is to help other people come to that understanding that services will help. And that's been what our fears are and what we keep on talking about. And in this impact of Medicaid peer support utilization on cost article by Landers and Zhao, we find evidence that, in fact, peer support was associated with $2,100 higher prescription drug cost and $5,116 higher professional services cost. And so it's not working in getting people out of the system. It's not, which is what, you know, when people talk about what is recovery, this is part of what the problem is that people have really different ideas on this idea of quote-unquote recovery and whether or not it really exists. And then where is the independent external advocacy? Where is the true informed consent about the lack of validity and reliability? Even the director of the National Institute of Mental Health, INSO, said it. There's the DSM does not have reliability. So where is the information that is being given about how much money is being made from these drugs, how little they know about what the drugs do, how the SSRIs cause the black box warning for suicidality warning on the SSRIs? Where is the true informed consent being given? And even in terms of the testing that is done. And so while I've seen in several different places it written in on the website of the International Association of Peer Supporters and in the national practice standards that it's not somebody's job to tell them what to do about their medication or anything, we know that when people are in these jobs, that they're also regulated as to whether or not they're taking their drugs. And so when somebody has some kind of emotional response to what's going on in their workplace, instead of it being that this person is passionate about what it is they're experiencing, they're asked whether or not they've taken their medication that day. And their job, very often, is contingent upon their compliance with their own quote-unquote treatment. So if you've got something to say about any of this or anything else for that matter, give a call, area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. If you need a toll-free line and are only not calling because you don't have toll-free and you live in the U.S., the toll-free line is area code 855-346-3351, 855-346-3351. There's also some people who have expressed interest in maybe having this conversation at another date, and tonight just wasn't a good night for them. But I have a real question about what does this mean with the fact that Peer support was associated with $2,100 higher prescription drug cost and a $5,116 higher professional services cost. So you know, yes, it's keeping people some amount of people out of getting institutionalized, which is great because institutions should be shut down. It shouldn't even be an option that people can go should be sent to institutions. But people are engaged in more services, and the cost is being shifted to these things that are presumably are happening in the community. And it's a real big question as to whether or not that real issue with the concern that those of us have about once it's certified that you can forget any shot of having any kind of mutual relationship with somebody, and that the job of quote-unquote peers is going to be to convince people to get into services. And so if you're holding on the line and you want to speak, make sure that you've pressed 1 so I know to patch you in. And, you know, on the in the national guidelines, you know, the first guideline, and this is a guideline that's put out by the, it says National Practice Guidelines for Peer Supporters, and the recovery, this is a quote, recovery is a process of change through which individuals improve their health and wellness, live a self-directed life, and strive to reach their full potential. And that was last updated in 2011 in this 2012 publication that I'm reading. And that's the SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, working definition of recovery. And so the National Practice Guidelines for Peer Supporters then starts off by saying, quote, the belief that recovery is possible for all who experience psychiatric, traumatic, or substance use challenges is fundamental to the practice of peer support. The likelihood of long-term recovery is increased with effective support. Peer support has been demonstrated through the research and practical applications to be highly effective. And it continues to say, in addition to the SAMHSA working definition and guiding principles of recovery, the following core values have been ratified by peer supporters across the country as the core ethical guidelines for peer support practice. And they list 12 core values which have been ratified. And the first is that peer support is voluntary. So I don't understand how if you are mandated, if you are in a place, I'm locked up in some institution, and there's somebody there who I now am talking to because they had been there at one point and they got out and now they get to be in there as like a less than staff person, more than patient kind of role. And I have to have this interaction with them. What does it mean for the person who believes that peer support is voluntary to be working in a place where people are involuntarily involved? Or things like an assertive community treatment team, where you have like a crisis team coming to your house and there's a quote-unquote peer on that team. And some of my friends work in these positions, and so I love anybody who I'm friends with who does this. No, I love you. This is not about you or your work or your beliefs. This is about this larger structure that's being created as an industry. I heard that there was a thing on California that they were expecting an influx of like 33,000 or 35,000 new roles, new paid positions in terms of peers who were being certified or in the process, or it potentially could open up 35,000 new positions. But this is an industry that's been created out of something that was really deeply rooted in the values of a civil rights movement. And that why is this Medicaid report have this, you know, why are they spending more money on drugs with people who are associated with peer support than people who aren't? I mean, this just kind of blows my mind. I mean, it says here on page E9, I think that's an E, maybe it's a 3, I don't know. Peer support, quote, peer support was also a significant predictor of higher professional cost and prescription drug cost. A review of additional descriptive data revealed that those who used peer support services had, on average, 2.5 times more professional claims than those who did not use peer support services. Of the professional claims, those who used peer support services had, on average, more than 3 times the number of community mental health claims than those who did not use peer support services. This result is supported by Hodges 2007, who suggested those who use peer support services are likely to utilize more services of all kinds compared with those who do not use peer support, and this may result in better overall quality of care. I'm sorry. End quote. This is ridiculous. Okay, so I'm going to keep on reading. Quote, the higher prescription drug cost appears to be driven by differences in the quantity of prescriptions between groups. Again, a review of the descriptive data showed that those who used peer support services averaged 113 prescriptions over the study period, while those who did not use peer support averaged 90 prescriptions. So either way, this is either 90 or 113 different prescriptions that we're talking about. So it's not like there's much of a difference because everybody, but there's more. There's more in people who are using peer support services. There's more medication costs. The article goes on to read, an unexpected finding from the facility cost model was that peer support was a significant predictor of lower inpatient cost, even after controlling for illness severity. And I don't know what that means. And that makes sense because you don't need to be in an institution. The institutions are bad, and any which way that you can get people to understand that there are alternatives that can be used in the community is obviously going to lower it. However, the bigger problem is that the costs in the community have gone up and that people who are involved with peer support, in this study anyway, that the Medicaid and managed care, that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, Office of Information Products and Data Analysis published, is clearly saying that people who are in peer support services are getting more drugs. And they're arguing, of course, that this is a good thing and that, you know, the cost, you know, that administrators need to weigh out the cost because it costs slightly more to have peer services, but that perhaps it's, you know, just creating a better, well-rounded psychiatric system, and that this should continue. And so if you've got something to say about this or anything, give me a call at area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. Do you live in a state where there's already certification? Are you a New Yorker who's in the process of having to go through the Academy of Peer Services and get certified? What are your experiences with this? What are your ideas about it? And then how do you meet the national guidelines, the very first core value, that peer support is voluntary when people are being held in involuntary places? Somebody called the other day and said that they have peer specialists being the person who's collecting somebody's urine. Like, how is that? You know, peer supporters are hopeful, open-minded, empathetic, respectful, facilitate change, honest and direct, mutual and reciprocal. Equally shared power. Value number 9, equally shared power. How is going and collecting somebody's urine an equal share of power? I mean, even how is it that, like, if you're in one of these peer positions that you can't even go out for coffee socially with somebody who is in the traditional psychiatric system who you may be coming in contact with through your work? How is there any mutuality here? And so on what level is any, you know, any really good efforts that any individual is trying to make, right? Because this isn't about the individuals. This is about the structure and what people are being told and taught. Why is it allowed to be called peer? And so here we come back to this long debate about the use of the word, you know, quote unquote, peer to begin with. But, you know, when you look at the practice guidelines that are put out in the national standards, the very first guideline is peer support is voluntary. And the ethical guideline is peer support is voluntary, and the practice guideline is that the practice is support choice. And so under practice guidelines, they write, peer supporters do not force or coerce others to participate in peer support services or any other service. But if you're there on an assertive community treatment team or a mobile crisis team where the goal is that this person is going to be brought in for involuntary psychiatric evaluation, then how are you meeting the ethical and practice guidelines of the idea of what peer support is? If you have something you'd like to say about this, it's area code 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. And the toll-free line is area code 855-346-3351. And so just going again through the national guidelines, the second ethical guideline is peer supporters are hopeful, and the practice is to share hope. And so, you know, I've been... peer supporters are hopeful. And I have so much hope that, you know, that you can get out of the situation that you're in and get into a life that is closer to the one that you want, and that it's a daily struggle, and that people, you know, that people can and do and ought to be given every opportunity to get out. But the idea that, well, I'll just read to you what they say. They say, quote, "Belief that recovery is possible brings hope to those feeling hopeless. Hope is the catalyst of recovery for many people. Peer supporters demonstrate that recovery is real, that they are evidence that people can and do overcome the internal and external challenges that confront people with mental health, traumatic, or substance use challenges. As role models," there's that thing again, role models. "As role models, most peer supporters make a commitment to continue to grow and thrive as they, quote, walk the walk in their own pathway of recovery. By authentically living recovery, peer supporters inspire real hope that recovery is possible for others." And so while I agree with almost all of that, I also have some extreme issues with the ideas of being a role model and having to be hopeful. Like, you know, like that hope is not, hope by itself is not the solution here. And of course, they don't present it as the only solution. I don't want to make it seem like that. But area code 609, your line is open.
Hello?
Yes, hi.
All right, hold on. Yeah, this is Jason from New Jersey. I just wanted to try to join the discussion and say that I've had, I've been to some of these trainings. I went to about 5 or 6 of these trainings in New Jersey to become a peer supporter, peer advocate. And I didn't really like what I was hearing. And, you know, I feel that I've been damaged by the treatments, and that's part of the reason why I couldn't even finish the assignments and everything in order to get the, you know, certificate or complete the trainings. I think there were 18 or 21 trainings that I had to do, and I did like five. I did get in. I managed to get in, and I just didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to be in a position to, you know, be on some treatment team and be pushing these treatments that I believe are counterproductive. And that point you brought up about being, you know, working in an institution or something where people are housed in, there involuntarily, and that's a good point. And
I mean, I thanks for calling in, Jason, and
yeah.
I really, you know, I really can relate to a lot of this. I think that, you know, one of the things, the way that they have this posed is that you need to be able to, like, have gone through school in order to be able to provide mutual support to somebody who's had you've had a shared experience with. And so at its very base, it, like, slices right against the entire point of what mutual support was about, right?
Yeah.
Because
and you mentioned the, you know, the liberation movement, and that's kind of what was on my mind there. You know, being recovered for me means not really being in the system in any way. I don't find their help supportive, most part. And so that's what was on my mind. You know, I was thinking this was about becoming like an independent advocate for people, to provide unbiased information and to be supportive as a, you know, more as a friend, not as someone being paid or something like that. And you know, there were like 30 people. There were about 60 people who showed up, and about 25 or 30 people got accepted for the training. And that's what was on my mind, and I tried to talk to other people about it, and they seemed kind of clueless, and I was concerned. I thought there would be more people with concerns about real recovery and what the treatments really were. There was really no mention of that. I mean, it wasn't really touched on at all, I don't know.
Yeah, well, I agree with you completely, and I'm sorry you went through that, but I know that I got involved in all of this late '91, '92, and so I know that if I had to do any of this, that I would not have gotten involved. I would not be doing what I do today. I would not have been involved with any of this, and it's such a tragedy that so many people who have survived these things, who are looking for an outlet to educate others, try to prevent what happened to them, prevent what happened to them happening to others, to demand that our civil constitutional human rights are not violated, these kinds of things, to be given accurate information. In nowhere, and anybody who I'm wrong, if I'm wrong, call me and tell me I'm wrong.
Yeah. Right.
But anybody inside of this peer national guidelines and stuff, there is no challenge to the whole idea of this being some kind of, like, psychiatry being legitimate. There's no challenge to any of it. So how is anybody being trained in this to even know? And then there's a job, and people need jobs, right? And so what are you supposed to tell, people to do? You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, it's a job, but so many people wind up really trying to, and they've written about this, trying to reshape themselves as, like, junior case managers. And in some places, they're even called junior case managers. And, you know, in the 90s, it was, I'm not a case and I don't need to be managed. Like, that was a slogan of the idea that we're not. So now you have peer case managers. And And they're under suspect too, Jason. And I think that this is one of the things that, you know, certainly the research that I just finished did that showed, and something that was of my own experience, that if you are speaking out and you're in one of these peer roles, you're likening yourself to a greater risk of being
right.
institutionalized. I mean, obviously, fired, loss of position, loss of power, but institutionalized and drugged also. All over the country, people talked about these kinds of things.
I mean, I understand that going from being a, you know, someone without a job, a mental patient without a job, to having this is, you know, is empowering or something. But the idea of it just struck me as something I just didn't want to do. that it was going against what I believed in, and I'm not gonna. It was like they were training to just kind of soften the way for people to for standard treatments. I mean, there was some talk of alternatives a little bit, but you know, we started talking about the DSM and everything, just the standard stuff. I was turned off. And
although I got to tell you, when I've been to different trainings over the years, and I think training is important, and I think people should be educated. I just think what they're being trained and educated into is really skewed and supports the fraud of psychiatry. I mean, I'm not against people getting trained and thinking that people should expand their understanding as much as they can. But, you know, when the results are that people involved with peer support are making more claims and having higher professional cost and higher drug prescription cost, according to the Centers for Medicaid and Managed Care, why? As opposed to people who aren't involved with peer support. So why are the people who are involved with peer support getting more drugs and services, and the people not involved with peer support getting less of that? Still a lot, I mean, by their numbers. I mean, it was 90 versus 113, you know, so there's not much of a difference. But still less if you're not involved with peer support.
Right. And what are you reading from? When did those statistics come?
Oh, I don't know what data came out, but it's a publication of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services from the Office of Information Products and Data Analysis, and it's volume 4, number 1, 2014. So I'm guessing it came out this spring. And it's the title of it is The Impact of Medicaid Peer Support Utilization on Cost. And it was written by Glenn Landers and Mei Zhao at Georgia State University, Georgia Health Public Policy Center. And so it goes through this entire thing, and in the results, it says peer support was associated with $5,991 higher total Medicaid cost. It was associated with higher crisis stabilization cost and associated with higher prescription drug cost and higher professional services cost. The only thing it had lower hospitalization cost with, the only thing it had lower cost with is psychiatric hospitalization, which is good, right? Because you want people to not be locked up in institutions. So that's obviously good. But even though they're not getting in institutions, they're now creating higher cost, which means that people are being subjected to more drugs and services.
Right, it's the same treatments are going on just outside the institution.
Right,
they're diverting some people from the hospital.
They're diverting some people from the hospital, and at the same time, increasing the use of services, particularly drugs, is concerning. And this goes back to like my fear that people are being trained into something. You know, all of the people at the table who are making these rules, obviously, and they know the values, but you go generation or two generations down, and you're gone. And where you have classes cycling every 14, 18 weeks with people getting jobs as trainers, going out there,
right?
They just don't know what the actual history is because the government didn't let us write it down. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is what the government is doing, and it's really really concerning, and I'm wondering what people's perception of this article that just came out is. and you know, I need to read it a lot more closely, but you know, and try to understand. Excuse me, try to understand, because they said they tried to like control for things like severity of illness, whatever the hell that is. And how they control for that and such. So I'm not exactly sure whether the methodology was, you know, really well done or not. I'm not saying it's not. I just don't know. But that there is a... It says peer support was also a significant predictor of higher professional costs and prescription drug costs. I mean, that's on page E9 of this article. So... If you, I mean, what kind of sales pitch is that to somebody like you or myself who wants nothing to do with this? If you're involved with peer support, chances are, if you're not involved, you might get locked up. But if you are involved, chances are that you're going to be on more drugs and in more services. How is that anything that this original movement worked to do? I just, it's really mind-blowing to me.
It would be great if someone out there, if anyone out there listening would call in.
It sure would be. And the number to do that is area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. The toll-free line, if you need it, is area code 855-346-3351.
I guess I do my own independent peer support work through the drop-in center and running groups and things like that. And I think it's been useful to other people, and I'm able to give them, you know, information about my you know, experience using the services that are offered to us. You know, things like the harm reduction guide and other things like that, and hearing voices and informed choices.
I mean, I think, and that's what winds up getting lost a lot inside of, like, when it's now Medicaid billable and a certification. If I can't go for a cup of coffee with you because of because I'm paid and you're and there's a power differential, how is that? That's not a real mutual support group.
Right.
This idea of mutual support and mutual assistance and alternatives are all very, very real, and I'm not challenging them in any way. And I think it's important that people get involved in genuine kinds of things.
Even when I was reading, I got the book about Soteria.
Mm-hmm.
And was reading about that, and reading about the people, you know, not just how the whole thing worked, and that they were, it was kind of, you know, it was allowed. You were allowed to, you know, the people who came through Soteria and benefited, you know, came back, and they were friends with the people who were working there, you know, who were hired to work there, to be with people,
And they have
that seems like a better program, you know, that model. And the guy called in last night, Kevin, I think his name is Kevin Phipps, was talking about another, you know, we have to present a model, you know, an alternative model of help people in distress, and you know,
and
there are models. They need some sort of funding and or more professional interest and support, or if there are existing professionals who also have problems with the way things are done now, It would be great.
And there are pockets of them. Yeah, there are are pockets of them. And Peter Bragan, John Breeding, there's people who are actively doing these kinds of things. Lauren Mosier with Soteria House, what a loss and what a great contribution he made to this world. And so I think it's important for, what Kevin was talking about is that we need to be having people look at the alternatives.
I wish there were houses like that in every, community. Like it was almost would that ever be possible? I mean, to have places like that were just, almost like a church or something, Just these community centers that were designed to, and the people who kept them going were,
I don't know, a public house? I mean, like, this is, these are things that have been stripped away from us. And so that there's, something that where somebody can go and go through it and come out stronger and see it as a learning experience. I do want to say that there are a couple of people online. If you want to join in the conversation, just press 1 on your phone so that I know to patch you in.
I guess mainly the people at Soteria, where they were first taught, they tried to get people who were having their first episode or experience. And that guy Kevin mentioned, open spaces or just places where people could go to find support.
And it's really hard. And so while some people argue that with the Medicaid billable, it makes the practice of peer support more widespread, when it's happening in terms of these involuntary situations or under these bizarre certification terms of how it is that you're supposed to interact with people and keeping records. Like, how is it, if you and I need a plan in order to have any kind of time be able to spend with each other, and I need to be the one to write you need to be the one to write my plan in order to be able to spend any time with me, and then you have to keep notes about what I'm doing with my plan.
Yeah.
This isn't peer support. I don't know what it is, but it sure as hell isn't peer support. And but the government is still, there's, even though people are using more services and on more drugs, the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services says administrators should weigh out, the lower cost in hospitalization for the higher cost in, getting people into more services, and that they're seeing that as something that's good. And of course they want more people in the services.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like it's a machine. That's their goal. And so how do you break it, and how do you get people who are interested in those kinds of things to get interested in the liberation movement? Right.
Mm-hmm.
And to see it. And it's all fine and good. You might be an individual who's been doing this for decades, who's never been involved in any kind of issue of force or coercion or uninformed anything. You may never have been present when it was happening. You may never have condoned it, seen it, been asked to do it, But there are also staff members who have never been involved in a restraint or seclusion episode, right? So just because you haven't yourself had this experience or would never do it based on your own values doesn't mean that somebody else who doesn't have your experience and values and knowledge is going to be able to stand up to it as easily.
Right.
And I think that that's one of the places where people really wind up then being in such despair, because they've invested years of their life in getting trained and having this belief that this is the answer and this is the thing, and then they find out that it's not really real, and that it's fabricated, and that it's paid, and that you know, you're not really mutual. And that experience is devastating.
I saw an interesting video the other night, and I can't find it or tell anyone where to find it, but I was looking up, I think I did a search for, it was a man in London working in Maudsley Hospital, and he said that he was an independent peer advocate, and he wasn't being paid by the hospital or anyone, and I don't know if I can find the video again, but it was about a 15-minute video, and a woman was interviewing this guy, and he was really just there to I'm not sure. I wish I knew more about it, but there, I guess there are ways to do this without being part of the system. I don't know. Maybe I can find out more about that.
I think in unfunded kinds of ways there are, but as soon as you formalize it, I mean, that's the danger of formalizing something, that it's going to then become institutional and structural, and if it wasn't to the T in what it was in its spirit and value going in. And so when you think of, like, you know, places where you're not allowed to write the word advocacy, right? Well, how, you know, or what is advocacy? Or, you know, in the research, one of the things that somebody said was, you know, as a peer support person, you're, you know, allowed to do advocacy up to a certain point, but advocacy doesn't include changing the entire psychiatric system and the practices of the psychiatrists, right? So there's like a line as to up to what point you can. So people are winding up helping people with very important needs, like getting housing, getting food, getting, you know, medical attention, like important jobs, you know, important stuff. And I'm not in any way discounting that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not advocacy in terms of protecting my rights from having these people not be allowed to do this to me. And
mm-hmm.
and I've yet to see you know, peer on an ACT team or a mobile crisis team. And if I'm wrong, please call and tell me. But I've yet to see somebody who has been able to successfully say to the psychiatrist, no, this person doesn't need to, you know, be forced into this. You know what I mean? Like, you know, maybe go to court, maybe they'll say it, but that the psychiatrist will listen, you know, and that they won't lose their job. I think that's a real issue that people are up against in trying to do it. It does say in this article, our results showed peer support to be associated with higher total Medicaid cost, higher Medicaid drug cost, higher Medicaid professional cost, and lower facility cost. The relationships between peer support, crisis stabilization, and psychiatric hospitalization were not significant except in the sub-analyses. While the implementation of Medicaid-financed peer support programs may not result, on average, in savings from reduction of costly crisis stabilizations and psychiatric hospitalizations, it does support the principles of self-direction and recovery from severe mental illness. State policymakers must weigh the potential higher costs associated with peer support programs with efforts to redesign the delivery of mental health services and to support the principles of self-direction and recovery. And so I'm not clear as to how, like, more drugs and more services equals recovery.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody's got an answer to this, the number to call in is area code 267-521-0167. First-time callers, more than welcome. Toll-free line, 855-346-3351. 855-346-3351. And if you're holding on the line, be sure to press 1 so I can patch you in.
Personally,
sorry.
You know, for me, recovery, you know, has been stopping the drugs, stopping the treatments, and stopping being associated with a psychiatrist and the system as much as I can, and seeing a therapist who shares the same beliefs, and that's where my if you can call it that. I mean, I feel like I'm really recovering from the treatments and the interventions.
Right. Right.
Okay.
I don't know if you want to talk about that at all for people who may be tuning in for the first time and may not know.
I can talk about it. I mean, I can talk about electroshock. I can talk about all the drugs I've taken over the years for 20 years, how I got into the system at 18. You know, where I was, what happened, what was going on with me before I was first put into incarcerated for 6 months and kept in seclusion for a month and drugged until I was, unconscious and put in a straitjacket and taken down and put on lithium and, 10 or 12 years of that. And then, I graduated from high school. Didn't really have any direction, and I guess I was depressed, so I started to isolate, and that led to seeing a psychiatrist. That led to imipramine, a tricyclic antidepressant, which caused me to become psychotic. I had a manic reaction, I guess they would call it, and that's what led to my hospitalization and my career as a mental patient, and I regret seeing a psychiatrist. I wish, I had known about alternative Zen. I wish they were available. I wish they were prominent. Because I'm damaged and I'm recovering from before I agreed to have the electroshock, I found evidence that I'd been researching some things about, withdrawing from the drugs and things like that. I managed to get off the drugs.
What torture.
It was torturous. It's been a torturous journey. The electroshock is torturous. The aftermath is hellish, not knowing who you are, and not having a self. I'm 42 years old. I this started when I was 18, I believe what they were telling me about myself and about this so-called illness, and that I needed treatment. I need to be on this stuff for life. I believed that everything, and I became. But, after during the electroshock and near the end of it and afterwards, I was so freaked out and terrorized that I realized that, this is absolutely just the wrong way, to try to change and get well, and that's when I discovered, the mind freedom, and
yes, and
other survivors.
Right, and mind freedom as an alternative to this, and other, is a really good place to look to for what can be natural, not natural as in non-institutionalized, non-funded kind of supports between people. And I did talk with Celia, and I'm going to put the two of you together, and that's a very exciting thing.
Oh, good, yeah.
And so I think that, people who may be listening, who may not be aware of Mind Freedom International, it's a organization that's got over 10,000 members, and it does phenomenal work around educating people about informed consent, and the Mind Freedom Shield Alert which anybody can, any member can have and activate when is necessary if you're ever involved in a forced treatment situation. But it's not pure specialists. And again, no disrespect to anybody, any individual who is working as a peer specialist. I believe that whatever our avenues are, that we've all gotten out to it. But if you were the last person who had to make a decision, it wouldn't be an issue. But because the traditional system, especially for those working in involuntary kinds of places, that they're making the final decision, so you, very often people just become cooperating with the oppression of another person, who in the liberation movement is called our sister or brother, you know, and not a quote unquote peer, and because we're just, so it's really concerning. If you're holding on the line and would like to join in the conversation, please press 1 to let me know and I'll patch you in. And if you'd like to call in, the number is area code 267-521-0167. And the toll-free line is 855-346-3351.
I was never able to finish school. You know, I was taking drugs at the time when I tried to break away and live on my own and go to school, and I was going to art school. And, I'd gone to school and worked before that, you know, and then people were telling me, you know, don't do too much. You know, you can't work full-time. You can't do too much. But, you know, I did get to school, and I was never able to finish. And this was around the time when all the drugs were coming out, SSRI. So they changed me from lithium integritol, which I'd been on for 10 years or something. Terrible. And they were starting putting me on these new drugs. I was going through withdrawal. I couldn't finish school. I couldn't finish my senior year. I couldn't graduate. I don't have a degree. I don't, you know, my education, and now my memory is just really gone. I mean, I could give you an outline of my life the past 20 years, a sparse outline, but there's nothing
from the
left.
Electroshock.
Yeah, from the electroshock. You know, before that, I was still doing art, and I still had hobbies, and I was still passionate about, you know, certain things, and I'd started new things, and now that's gone. So these treatments and these interventions that they use can really just have a devastating impact on your life and your sense of self and your goals. And then also, you know, I can't even, it's hard for me to set goals now and accomplish things. I mean, you know, I'm really kind of just floating, drifting. I may as well be homeless. I mean, I have a home and a supportive family, but the way I live is not really fulfilling, and I do think it's because of the treatments I've had, you know.
And they're not treatments. This is torture. These are crimes against humanity. And they sell it. They bill it to us, and they sell it and as if it's going to be helpful and that it's going to have some kind of answers, and they just destroy our bodies and minds and souls. And it's crimes against humanity, and they need to be stopped, and people need to... What would happen if all of a sudden tomorrow every single peer specialist or peer supporter in the United States and all over the world said the only thing we are going to talk about is how if under involuntary or voluntary circumstances that these things cause grave bodily injury and death, and that there are alternatives that people can use? What would happen if that, with all of these thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in these roles in this emerging industry, were saying that you have a choice, you have a choice to have your brain destroyed. You have a choice, right? Like, because this is voluntary and this is choice. Is there this principle, right, in the national guidelines? the national guidelines on peer supporters. Peer support is voluntary. Peer support is hopeful. It's all these things that peer support is, but...
Yeah, that sounds, a lot of that stuff I agree with, too. It sounds really good, you know, but when I was there doing the training, I started to feel like we were just being indoctrinated into the current beliefs and stuff, so I left, but that wasn't the only reason I left, you know. It's also because I'm impaired now because of the treatments, and those are the things, very things that they were emphasizing as helpful.
I think that's so much of what the problem is that, you know, you have people who are coming in who have been, like, with intention, have been subjected to brain damage, and then the way the material is even presented, you wind up losing, what you said, half more, or just under 25 or 30 people out of, like, 60 people went through, and so you're losing all of these people because you're formalizing something that was never supposed to be formal.
Right, okay, yeah.
So, but even if in a training or education, there are so many alternative ways in which people learn in creating experience as a way, because real, true learning is when an experience changes the way one goes about the world and their activities. Mm-hmm. And the way one, with this new knowledge, you now see the world in a different way. And so there are so many ways to convey the information, but because they're trying to make themselves look, you know, like a quote-unquote evidence base so that they can get money from Medicaid, everything is being filed out in this way that is very, like, the antithesis of how people originally learned about this thing called mutual support or self-help or any of these mm-hmm. other things, or, you know, that, or independent external advocacy. Like, you know, I remember the day I met George Ebert, and he said, well, you know, where I was very much on multiple drugs in psychiatrist's office multiple times a week, all mm-hmm. this kind of stuff. And he said, well, maybe it doesn't have to be like that forever. And that was where my learning happened. Like, wait a second. You know what I mean? Like, maybe it doesn't have to be like that forever. And then all of a sudden, it was, I mean, it was hard and arduous and incredibly painful, and I did it in a way long before the harm reduction guide came out, so I didn't know about what withdrawing from psychiatric drugs was like, and I wouldn't recommend anybody to have to go through that kind of experience of severe withdrawal. I don't think it was, useful. But it was an immediate shift in my understanding. Mm. And when your choice is whether or not you talk to me as a peer specialist instead of me being there as a person who can come in as an independent external figure to the institution that you're involved with and advocate on your behalf on what it is that you want, you know, the memorandums of understanding that they used to do and that, like, the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance really created a phenomenal template for example, was that it was an agreement between the institution and the alliance that the alliance would be able to do advocacy for people who were institutionalized, but did not work for the institution. So if the person who's doing the quote-unquote advocacy
That's what I was expecting. That's what I thought I was going to be doing when I volunteered to do this, you know. And it's not what I found, so I left. So, but that's exactly what I was expecting, something like that. And really, I talked to other people there and tried to find out why they were there and probe a little bit, but no one else really seemed to be there for that reason. And when I talk to people at the drop-in center, I kind of, you know, I, t- I tell I, I I guess I kind of do what George Ebert did, you know, for you, was to say, you know, suggest that it doesn't have to be that way, that you don't necessarily have to be on all these drugs and
just being exposed to the fraud of it. I had never, like, before stumbling over the Alliance, I had never been told that this was, that there was even side effects. I was on lithium and Melaril. I had no idea of the side effects that I was being subjected to. And you know, like, any kind of information about, like, you know, that the diagnosis isn't based in biology or that there is no evidence for this existing. You know what I mean? Because I really had gotten to the point in my life of where I did believe what I was being told. And I did buy into it. And, you know, if I, for the last 20 years, had stayed that route, there would have been a psychiatrist there, you know, patting me on my head every 5 minutes and mm-hmm. telling me that I was a good girl.
Was that a turning point, though, for you with meeting people from the Alliance?
Oh, meeting George Ebert? Yeah, I marked it as the exact. And then, of course, I met so many other people almost immediately. It was like I fell into this world that I didn't know existed, and it was quite remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
But even in there, it took me sometimes. And so sometimes people hear me talk, and they don't, you know, and they're like, oh, that's so, you know, like, wildly unrealistic or whatever. And part of the reason that I am so staunch in my belief system now is because I was so staunch in my belief system 20 years ago. And that I really bought into it. And I was, like, you know, brought up on stage in the youth movement as, like, you know, look at what can happen if you take your medication and do all that. And when I realized that I'd been being lied to and everything, that was when it really changed. And I'm not saying that it's been, like, without struggle, but it's definitely worth the struggle. And I don't think that any peer specialist today, you know, or maybe not today, but once all of this Medicaid billing stuff really comes through and it's all set and solid, because, you know, New York doesn't have this, so this is all new to me in having to contemplate the ideas of Medicaid billable peer support. You know, it's very far away from what
will
I understand.
Do you know if this will be nationwide in every state? Because that's kind of the sense I'm getting, right? Yeah.
Yeah, because it's like in 36 or 33 states now.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's in tough competition with the involuntary outpatient commitment laws that they want to make national. Area code 603, your line is open.
Hi, Lauren. This is Julie Tessier calling from New Hampshire. And I just
Hi.
Want to let you know that folks may have had trouble calling in. I had great difficulty, but it's okay now. So
you,
let them know if they
Jeannie,
call now that they can
Jeannie,
get you on speakerphone.
Jeannie, I'm having a little trouble hearing you. Yeah, are you on speakerphone?
Nope.
Are you on speakerphone?
No, I'm not.
Oh, okay. I'm just
no,
having
muffled.
A little trouble hearing you. So if you could maybe speak up a little bit, or
okay. Let's see. Can you hardly hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. Well, I'm really glad that you're doing this show. I give you a lot of credit because it's a difficult discussion, but it's one that we need to have. And I brought this up last year in New Hampshire, and I just got, you know, people gave me a really, really hard time when I brought up issues of the peer support agencies here in New Hampshire. So I know that there's a lot of people doing a lot of good work, and that's not what it's about.
No, it's not about that at all, because there certainly are.
But people took it as, I was hesitant to call tonight because of that, of what happened last year. But I remember going to the peer support agency in Concord, New Hampshire, for the empowerment team meeting, And it was run by the director of the Mental Health Center. And I thought, what is going on here?
The director of the Mental Health Center was running the peer meeting?
Was running the empowerment meeting at the peer support agency.
Great.
At one of the meetings, they came and told us that we were going to make posters to protest the budget cuts to the mental health centers.
They told you that's what you were going to be doing, huh?
But I actually worked as a peer support worker back in 1999, 2000, and it was totally different. It was much more informal, where you could really advocate for people, and it was much more flexible. Now they are in New Hampshire, we have only peer support agencies, and they are run by the Bureau of Behavioral Health. And the Bureau of Behavioral Health tells them exactly what they can and cannot do.
Right.
And they do groups all day. So I think it varies greatly from state to state and even from county to county, but there are some major issues that need to be addressed that aren't being addressed, and it does help a lot of folks because they're getting jobs and they're getting paid, but it's not. And I'll also answer your question about the increase in medications.
Uh-huh.
Their answer to that is that the reason for that is because we get this quote. Sickest people. So that's the answer to that.
I don't know what that is, but they said in here that they controlled for that. So that would be a wipeout issue for it, because they said they controlled for the most quote severe illnesses. They said that the chronic illness and disability payment system plus RX was used to control for illness severity. And so there's still a higher drug cost. But even still, if those who are being, labeled with the most severe things are the people who are getting pushed off onto the drugs.
That's right. And people who are probably... And now that that classification is being... severely ill or something. It's almost meaningless now because, you see people who have been on the drugs for, a decade or 5 years, a decade or longer. How can they even control for that? And how can that even be valid,
Right. With things like, the new labels of, severe depression or severe bipolar or severe... psychosis or whatever that the government and Tory loves using so much these days, and the fraud of it. How do you know this is severe?
Right.
You know what I mean? Outside of the fact that I've been trapped in you for years. But Jeannie, I think you brought up a really good important point that people should realize that years ago it wasn't like this.
Right. I commented on it was a post on the Stop the Mercy bill about the making it billable, and I commented that this is a really bad idea, and then, of course, someone commented, in response to me that, that's the most backward thinking I've heard in a long time, what I said. So they think, there are people that really believe that making it more, as much a part of the system as possible is actually somehow better. And that's what we've seen over the last 10 years. And I can only speak for, I think they have, I have a lot of contact with folks in Michigan, and it sounds like they have a really good peer support network there, but I can only speak for New Hampshire. But I wouldn't go to a peer support agency here if you paid me because it's so bad. But not all of them. I'm talking about the ones in the places where I've lived. Not helpful. So, you know, it's almost like if you speak up about these issues, your people, you're not supposed to speak up about these issues because it's all supposed to be wonderful, and it's not.
It's really not, and there's, again, I want to underscore, there are so many good fundamental ideas, but the way it gets carried out very often is just not good. Now, in New Hampshire, Jeannie, are you guys billable for Medicaid now, or are you still one of the states that's not billable? Because New York is just going through the billable issue, and so...
No, they're not. There's no effort to make it billable at all.
Well, that's good. That's live free or die, right?
But we only have peer specialists at the peer support agency. They're nowhere else. And the peer support agencies are really mini mental health centers.
Because they're controlled by the behavioral health people.
Right. And it's just one group after the next all day long. And groups are great, but the way it used to be is people could go and hang out and connect with people, and it was natural. It might have been too informal at that.
Yeah,
I didn't even get any training. It might have been too informal, but now they've gone to the other extreme, and the pay is less as well. So.
Yeah, I was looking at a thing that said it was like $6.70 an hour or something. That might be old data, but that like $7.45, and it was like half of what like rehab services get or something. But this is constructed, and that when these people are in these positions, the other thing that if you decide that you want to stop being involved with psychiatry because you're at a point of where you're feeling really good about what you've done with your life, they will fire you or limit your responsibility or power or institutionalize you and drug you. And you're at risk for being subjected to these people every day that you walk around them. At any given point, they can say, this is it. You're psychotic and you need to be locked up. And they've done it before, and they've been doing it since the early 1900s,
1930s. Yeah, you said Clifford Beer, right?
Yeah. Adolph Maillard locked him up, diagnosed him psychotic, and he died in an institution after he knew that.
Yeah, to David Hilton, who was the director of the Office of Consumer Affairs, and every 2 years he was involuntarily committed. And now they have turned the Office of Consumer Affairs into the Office of Consumer and Family Affairs, and it's run by family members. So you don't even have a...
God.
It's just, that's why I New Hampshire is like it's just really bad, really, really, really bad. So anyways,
it just seems to me that there's got to be some way to get people who have good ideas and really have something to offer to not buy into this and not support this idea of this very important part of getting out of the psychiatric system as something that is a service, and the power relationship between them, and God, what David must think. I mean, that's just the antithesis of everything that was trying to get done, right?
Well, he's rolling in his grave, because it's totally opposite of what he was all about, and his work was all about. It's just total co-option. And if you're not co-opted, then you're out of the loop. What Yvonne was talking about last night is really true, that if you happen to work for a peer support agency or go there or one of these statewide committees that happens, you're able to go to the conferences and trainings and all these other things. But if you're not, you're out of luck. And so
right. You
have this thing where the same people go every single time. And who's being empowered? If you have the same people, you're preaching to the choir, So, but this, I was really hopeful today because I had a young woman from New York. She's recently out of college. Who contacted me about helping with the mental health civil rights protest. She wants to help with the organizing. And I hope she comes on and talks about her experience with forced psychiatry and how she has gotten out. And it was just so great to connect with the young, I think she's in her 20s, and it's great to connect with someone that's younger that, really wants to change things.
Yeah, that's fabulous. And the mental health civil rights protest page that you're organizing on Facebook, if you put mental health civil rights protest in the search bar on Facebook, it'll pull right up. And this is about organizing a D.C. protest, right?
Right.
And getting back to our roots of organizing and getting our voice to the government about what's going on here. And I think on all sides it really makes sense that the government realize that there are people who aren't going to just sit and accept that this is happening.
Yeah.
And that we need to, as a community, rise up and let them know that we have a vote and that there are many of us and there are millions of us over time who have been subjected to this, and hundreds of thousands of people in any given week in New York State, for example. And so it's very important for people to get involved and come out and speak out and, especially on these hot topics, Jeannie, the idea of talking about this industry that's been created, nobody wants to do it, and I really believe we must, because if we're just, like somebody was saying the other night, collecting somebody's urine, that's now the job of the peer specialist, how much more power over somebody is there than taking their bodily fluids from them and bringing them to the master, to be tested. And so, it's just, I don't know, that it just is really horrifying to me that this is what the idea of mutual support has become. And if people want to learn, go ahead.
Well, I'm just going to say, you might want to announce the number again, because I had a lot of difficulty getting through. It kept saying there are no shows in the next 24 hours, but I finally got through. But I'm going to go now, and maybe some other folks will be able to get through. Because some reason
okay.
It's very difficult to get through tonight. And it was good talking to you guys, and have a good weekend.
Okay, thanks so much, Jeannie. I'll see
thanks.
You online.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Okay, and that...
Should I make it easier for other people to get through if I get off the line?
No, because there are actually room for 50 people to be on the line at any given one time.
Okay.
So I'm not exactly sure what's happening, and I'm sometimes maybe the service is off.
I had a little trouble too because I was dialing for a while and I got cut off a few times, but it finally went through. So.
Yeah, so let me give the numbers again. It's area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167, And if you need a toll-free line, it's area code 855-346-3351. And there are a couple of people hanging out on the line, so if you're trying, if you want to jump in on the conversation, just press 1 on your phone, and I will bring you in. Because I think it's really, really important that we talk out and we remember our history and we remember of what it used to be like, of where people were, you know, there's a, for anybody who doesn't know, Madness Network News publication that was phenomenal in the 70s and 80s. There's pictures of them, like, having sleep-ins in politicians' offices and legislative buildings. People just really speaking out and being heard. And we've become, in some ways, really reliant on people who are in these positions to do it for us. And if they speak out against psychiatry, they get shut down. And so they can't do it. And I think, like, with the Murphy bill, one of the things, H.R. 3717, which we still need to, like, really be keeping on guard about, as far as I'm concerned, and others, too. I've seen others, people saying, like, this isn't over and we shouldn't trust this. But Murphy is calling SAMHSA anti-psychiatry. And the last thing the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration is anti-psychiatry. And so we need to speak out to let them know that that's not what anti-psychiatry is, and that there are these alternatives that people can utilize, and that we can continue to grow in a way that doesn't require being subsidized by the federal government and Medicaid, and then being under all the constraints that comes with. And I think that's the real concern, is all of the constraints. And if you're more likely to wind up on psychiatric drugs and services when you're involved with a peer specialist or a peer support person than not being involved, that becomes a real question as to the integrity of peer support and what that's about. And that the system looks for people. The people they hire aren't going to be people like me or Jason who have something negative to say about psychiatry. They're going to hire the people who are going to, you know, push their line. And that becomes another real problem about even being able to get to the table, going back to, again, what Yvonne was saying the other night. If you're not singing their tune, you're not sitting at their table. And if you are, you're not listened to, and it's just sometimes you're brought in as a way to eliminate any possible organizing you might do against the effort. And, you know, and it's a political game, and I don't know that the average person who doesn't really know the inner workings of all of this would be aware of that. Or the average peer worker would know that this is a political thing because of the way that it's sold, mm-hmm. and it is packaged, and it's you know, and at the same time there are alternatives that are available for people that should be supported.
I thought at the training I would meet more disgruntled, vocal, disgruntled patients or people, you know, but I didn't see that. I mean, whenever I talk to people, you know, even if they are agreeing to take the drugs, you know, and other, you know, conditions around their treatment plan, even if they are, there's always another story, you know. There's always this person who is not. I mean, really, in every case, almost every case when I talk to people, there's always a subtext or another. There's another story going on, and I think even people who feel they have no other choice, I find that when I really talk to them and get to know them, they're not happy about the way they're being treated. I mean. Because there's so many conditions that they have to meet one of those, you know, is the drugs, and just to feel like they have their head above water. So I try to give them information and expose them to some of this. I guess they're more radical, but I don't know what you'd call it, but these other views that have helped me start to break away and to see what's really happening. Because it is like a blinding force.
I think that that's just, yeah, I mean, that's at the heart of it. And I just want to, line 352, your line is open.
Hi, Lauren. This is Frank.
Hi, Frank. How are you?
I'm doing good. I've been listening the last couple of nights. I think one word that has not been used that perhaps should be used is corruption, because I see a lot of corruption there. I mean, with psychiatrists, they talk about conflict of interest. But with peer support specialists, you have something similar going on.
Yes. And so I think corruption is an important word to be talking about, because there is money being exchanged here, and money being exchanged with values being compromised. And so, could you talk a little bit more about because you've been doing this for years also, and your perspective of how this issue of certifying and making Medicaid billable peer services, you know, and what that corruption is looking like and going to further look like if they nationalize this?
Well, I think some people are just out after a government job, you know, and you make it convenient for them to get that. I mean, things have changed a lot since the way they used to be.
Could you talk about what it used to be like?
Well, I mean, before 1985, I'm not sure I could talk about what it used to be, but I mean, before 1985, it was not, you know, now they talk about the CSX movement, and it's paid for by the government.
Right.
So before that point, you had a movement that was perhaps smaller, but it was more of a purist movement. You didn't have so much corruption in it. Radicals involved.
That was things like the International Conference on Psychiatric Oppression and Human Rights, with that kind of, you know, late 70s, early 80s, the Madness Network News, all of those kinds of efforts that were being done, that I don't think the average person being trained as a, you know, quote-unquote peer specialist is informed about any of that.
I don't think so either. I mean, I think you've got a government-bought movement, because they know, because basically they've almost destroyed our movement through this process.
Yeah, you know, the other day somebody
wasn't originally. I mean, it was more of a consciousness-raising group too. I mean, before the, I guess.
Well, a much smaller movement, but yes, it was about consciousness raising.
Yeah.
I've been getting a lot of criticism as of late, or I don't know, some criticism from a small handful of people, I guess I should say, that when I say things like psychiatry is torture, or that this is slavery, or that they're, you know, murdering us, or what Sue calls genocide, and I agree with her that this is genocide, that it's, I'm making statements that make us not credible, and
there's
I don't
a
understand.
Lot of, yeah.
I don't understand how the people who are supposed to be representing this movement why they don't see that they're adding to this being seen as not credible. That every time they say that the original goals of the movement were not credible, that they destroy our movement a little bit more.
Well, I mean, it's not credible. It's real. I mean, there's so much deception in psychiatry. You get it from NAMI. You get it from these psychiatrists. I mean, they're talking about helping people with things that are harmful. Harm is not help.
That's right.
That's right.
And to say so is to be very deceptive. So I would like to say, you know, exactly, you know, I think that's the truth that needs to get out there. Lobotomy, insulin shock, you know, all of these things that were that are harmful to people. And electroshock is hardly different. It's the same
thing.
The whole
electroshock industry is a one big deception. I mean, it's as harmful or more harmful than it was. And, you know, how they claim that it's
They call it safe, but it is not safe. It's very harmful, and the only way you could do that is to lie.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And Linda Andre's Doctors of Deception, if you haven't, for listeners, if you haven't read it yet, go get it and read it. It will open your eyes to a lot of this deception and the corruption and how that's spilling over into this peer industry, that it is corrupt, it is deceptive, that more people, I don't know if you heard earlier, Frank, but a report from CMS just came out that you are more likely to wind up on psychiatric drugs and more services if you're involved with peer support than if you're not. And
I'm not surprised.
And so the only thing that you're not more likely to wind up is in an institution, which is good, and they should be shut anyway. But why are people involved in peer support more likely to be on drugs and in services? Because they're being lied to by people who are being lied to. And getting back to the roots of our movement, I think, is so important. And I wasn't around in 85. I was locked up when I was 15 in 1988. And, the work that all of you were doing on some level probably spared me a lot of torture. But yet when the federal government bought out the conference and what is now the Alternatives Conference and the messaging that can come out of these organizations, I'm catching flack for this from every corner of the world.
Well, feeling is that the alternative line wins there. Okay, you've got alternatives, but they forget that it was alternatives to forced treatment.
Right.
We were all about. I mean, it was people not only opting for alternatives, but opposing forced treatment.
Right, and somebody told me that, like back in 85, that what they called it was the alternative to the movement, that when they established the Alternatives Conference, that it was the alternative to the movement, and that it really, over the last, 35 years, has shown its effects. And that you have all of these, tens of thousands of people working in these roles who don't know the first thing about what the movement was initially about. Or if they challenge and say something, at risk of, losing their job or being institutionalized again themselves. And it's just bad business.
What is alternatives about if it's not about alternatives to force and alternatives to harm?
Mm-hmm. What is the Alternatives Conference? I was trying to learn a little bit about that recently. And when did that start, this thing called Alternatives?
It started in 85, the year I'm talking about. But that was the last year they had a conference on human rights and against psychiatric oppression.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's sponsored by the Substance Abuse.
Okay.
And I'm just looking at the Alternatives website now. We invite everyone to consider becoming a presenter, first-time presenters are especially welcome. Learning from each other is a clear example of self-help, mutual support, and the principles of recovery in action. Each alternatives conference offers in-depth technical assistance, whatever that is, on consumer survivor-delivered services and self-help recovery models. The Alternatives 2014 Conference Committee, which includes consumer survivor leaders from across the nation, is seeking proposals for presentations in the following areas, although proposals need not be limited to the following subjects. And their subject areas are peer-led programs, leadership development, integration of physical health with behavioral health care, my God, technology, yeah, alternative therapies, and diversity and inclusion.
Well, I mean, something's forgotten there, I think, or something's really off. Because I mean, you might talk about diversity and inclusion, but the mental health system is expanding. You know,
quickly.
You're getting more people. Yeah, yeah. You're getting more people labeled mentally ill on these drugs. And the peer support movement, the peer support specialists are contributing to this.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
It really is so heart-wrenching that there is not a word about advocacy, not a word about rights, integration of physical health with behavioral health care. Who mm-hmm. needs this? Who needs this of where you go to your general practitioner? How many people have called? Even Jason, I think you called. That you
yeah,
go because you have some
it.
medical issue, some clear, apparent physical thing happening, and now all of a sudden you have to go through a mental health evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
And,
are you suicidal?
And with the,
are you yeah, you know, and I just...
And like Yvonne always mentions, the electronic medical records, that this is it. It's sealed. It's a done deal. And now you're going to have these people who are presenting themselves to other people who are locked up as their equals when they're not. How are you equal if you are keeping notes on somebody? I mean, you know. And the integration of physical health and behavioral health, and this whole idea of behavioral health, it's such a scam. It really is such
well,
a scam.
Well, encouraging, you know, people who have been through this system to become turncoats. In a sense, that's what's going on in many
yeah.
cases.
And
unless
for money,
you,
and that's
you know, yeah.
the corruption.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
sorry, Frank, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh, no, fine. But, I mean, people are, you're in the mental health system, and there are these people that are playing wardens, and so they hire some people that have been there. You know, in a sense, that's becoming a turncoat. Who do you represent? Who are you really, whose side are you really on?
It really is. Such nasty, and corruption is the perfect word. It's deception. It's a betrayal. The topic should be independent external advocacy, rights, and true alternatives that aren't, quote-unquote therapies, alternative therapies. So you can't even have, like, the alternative. The alternative is not being involved with the system anymore. The alternative is... getting the hell out and being able to reclaim your life and have your power restored.
Well, the problem is we really need people in the system who can opt for help rather than taking these drugs that are going to damage people.
Right.
You know what I mean? I mean, what's wrong with peer support if they're actually supporting their peers rather than
nothing.
With their, yeah.
Nothing. But that's not what people are being trained into doing. They're being trained
into how to
be case managers, keep records,
Basically do what the psychiatrist says. Because
right,
they're subservient to the psychiatrist
yeah.
who basically dominates the mental health field.
Yep. And it's a fraud with no evidence that these people can have so much power and with the backing of huge pharmaceutical industries, billions, trillions of dollars, the taxpayer dollars, not even talking about, you know, what the out-of-pocket pay an individual pays, but just tax dollars that go to this. It's a crime. It really is a crime.
You know, I was taking human services training. What that would have me do if I was hired by a fact team would be bring people these medications, and I couldn't do anything about it because the psychiatrist says so. So I
just
couldn't
doing
even
my
speak
job.
The truth. Yeah.
Just doing my job, doing the best I can. I'm walking the line here.
Well,
and
I
so
mean, I'd have to lie. I'd have to lie to work there. I couldn't tell a person the truth.
Right.
So,
and
so I pulled out. I said I wouldn't do that.
Good for you.
So, I didn't go through the training, but, you know, if I wanted to go to school, well, I could take
but,
anything else.
Yeah.
I,
and, Lauren, you keep
crazy.
Making the point that, and I saw a lot of these people who are younger, in their 20s, who have no idea about what we're talking about and what the movement, you know, was about and is. And I would say the majority of the people there were probably in that category.
Yeah, young people in this country need to watch out get educated and get alternative information. And if you don't know it exists, where do you don't even know to look. You know, if nobody's telling you and dropping this hint to you that, hey, there's another way, you don't even know, I didn't even know to
yeah.
look in a different place. And
well,
and then you have, it's not only these 20-year-olds.
Yeah, you're not going to get to be an old person if you go along according to what they're selling.
Right.
Because it's killing people.
It truly is killing people. And what we're doing, putting 3-year-olds on Haldol, like that this is legal, that this is even legal.
3-year-olds, that's crazy.
It truly is
mm-hmm.
crazy, and their technology is expanding, and they're putting electrical implant devices into veterans' brains to try to wipe things out, and you know, another 20 years, and they're going to be implanting babies of people who have been assigned psychiatric labels to prevent this from happening to them too, and it's you know, the idea that there is some kind of that they can do all these biological things to us when they have no biological evidence of anything going on. It's just a crime, and it's corrupt, and it's betrayal.
If you want to raise the mental health rate, target children and adolescents. It's going to go skyrocket, and that's what they're
yep.
doing.
Yep. A built-in consumer base, and the schools are pipelined right into the psychiatric industry now, mental health workers all over the place. And parents who refuse have their child, like Justina Pelletier, who still is locked up and needs to be freed, have their children taken away from them by Child Protective Services. It's a nightmare. Frank, I hear you and I are going to be doing some kind of panel discussion of some sort at the Mind Freedom Conference.
Yes, I believe we're going to be doing a panel. I'm going to be doing some kind of presentation on landing zones, and perhaps you'll be there and help me.
I will be there, and I think
we can do a co-presentation. Yeah.
I think that would be really exciting, and I think that we're also going to have some kind of more informal group after hours. I was talking the other day, and I heard this for people who want to like collectively organize around things and get messages out. And if anybody is interested in the Mind Freedom Conference, it's going to be in Connecticut from July 24th to the 27th. Esmond Green's 6th annual vigil is on June 19th from 4 to 6 p.m. in Brooklyn. And the Alliance's 34th annual Bastille Day vigil will be on the sidewalk in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health July 13th through the 16th. If you have a tip or would like to be on the show, or have an idea for a show, you can call the Talk with Tenny tip line at area code 718-273-8708. Jason, Jeannie, Frank, thank you all for calling in, and everyone else who's listening. I'm going to ask you all to keep on speaking out, and until I talk to you next time, talk to you soon. Thanks, everybody. Have a great night.
Night.
Good night.
Frank, I hope you'll come on one time and spend a lot of time talking.
I'll see about doing that early.
Okay, great. Thanks. Good night.
Good night.